I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah.
Hope everybody's paying attention today because we have a friend calling in from Los Angeles, and her name is Stephanie Wilder Taylor, and she has a new book out called Drunkish. She's a comedian. She's a TV personality. So I want to welcome Stephanie to the show. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you, John. Thank you for having me.
So it's a very interesting subject, Drunkish. Can you tell me a little bit about what your passion was behind this book?
Sure. I quit drinking over 14 years ago. This May it will be 15 years. And I was somebody who always felt like alcohol was just fun. And I wasn't somebody who had a really tragic story, who, you know, was getting DUIs or got divorced or lost my kids or went to any of it. So it was very easy for me to go, well, I'm a comedian, so I drink. All comedians drink. And, you know, and then when I became a mom, it was very, very stressful. So, of course, I became part of the mommy wine culture and enjoyed my wine. And I never thought it was a problem until it was a problem. I quit drinking, like I said, May 22nd, 2009, and I've been sober for a long time. I'm also an author. I'd already written a lot of memoirs. I became a little bit known for quitting drinking because my first book was called Sippy Cups Are Not for Chardonnay, and I joked a lot about drinking. In case anybody thinks that that was a book about sobriety, it wasn't. That was a book making a lot of jokes about how much I drank. In fact, if you look at the Amazon reviews, some of them were like, you sound like an alcoholic, which would make me very defensive and angry. These people don't know what they're talking about. They can't take a joke. You know, looking back, I was being funny about drinking. I was just making a lot of jokes. It was kind of in the zeitgeist, moms and their wine, rosé all day, all that, still kind of is. Anyway, the point is I'd already been known as an author. And then when I quit drinking, because I'd been known for writing these books where I talked a lot about drinking, it was in all the titles. I got some press, not unwanted press, because I quit drinking. So I decided after all this time of being sober, like, why not write another book and make it about the process of getting sober? So, you know, a lot of books about sobriety, they call it Quitlet. There's a ton of books about quitting drinking, a lot of memoirs about it. To me, most of them, the ones that I found, I can't say all of them, are pretty earnest. You know, they're dark stories, they're very dark admissions. And I wanted to write something that was relatable to people that are maybe thinking that they might have a drinking problem, but like me, feeling like, oh, it might not be that bad. I wanted to write a book for those people. And I also want it to be funny. So, you know, having a stand-up background and being a humorist, I decided that it was a needed book, some like much needed levity to the world of sobriety.
I have a lot of friends that drink, and I drink wine, drank tequila, stopped drinking tequila, still drink a little bit of wine now, but I feel like my body has pushed me. I'm a clairsentient, so I do things. I feel a lot of things. I can feel a room. I can feel people. I can get in people's heads. And, you know, when you apply the spiritual aspect of this, when I don't drink, my sensibilities are way, way more heightened. Can you talk to that about drinking and not drinking? And there are certain things that are, when you stop drinking, that are not discussed, you know, how it really affects you eternally. It's kind of a surfacey conversation, you know, the horror stories, this or that. But when you think about from a sensibility standpoint, could you see a change in yourself, in your sensibilities, and in how you live life? Because we live life through vibrations, and things we do with our life affect those vibrations. Did you recognize anything like that with yourself?
I think that's such a good question. And I'm not a woo-woo person at all. I am in a spiritual program that helps me to not drink. But what you bring up is rarely talked about, except among other people that don't drink. And it's so important to say that a big reason why a lot of people drink is to not be present. right? Is to kind of like numb out, blank out. And when you stop drinking, it's uncomfortable at first to be completely present and to, you know, I remember the feeling of early sobriety and like just sitting with my husband on the couch, like watching TV, felt hard to do because I wasn't used to that kind of to being truly intimate with another person where you're just both like, I liked to drink to numb it all out. And a lot of that I think comes from childhood and, you know, wanting to not be present and not feel. But when you start feeling, although it's unfamiliar at first, it's the biggest gift I think of quitting drinking is the feeling of like being fully present in my life with my kids. I'm a better friend. I'm a better, much better parent. You know, I'm a better wife. I'm more accessible and I'm more attuned, like you were just saying, to people's feelings and people's needs. And I'm not so afraid of those feelings. So it's helped me tremendously in ways that, you know, I thought I was drinking for that opposite effect. I didn't think mm-hmm. that I was going to have to deal with that or that I wanted to deal with that. All I knew when I quit drinking was I don't want to drink anymore because I'm unsafe and I make bad decisions when I drink every time. Not every time, but at some point, always, you know, every time I rationalize and I go, I'm fine. I'm just going to have a couple glasses of wine tonight and that's it. All of those promises I would make myself, I would always break them. And it makes you feel bad about yourself. But like I said, I was drinking for the sole purpose of not wanting to feel. And that is the biggest thing that I love about being sober.
And I want to take this a little bit deeper. I don't know if you know anything about me, but I've been in the comedy business, I don't know, 8 years. I discovered a comedian, took him to Just for Laughs, and within 2 years from the trailer park. And that's a whole nother story. But when you think about the personalities, especially in entertainment, mm-hmm. and when I think about people's feelings, and you think about the Western world and how things are described or what they think things are based on feelings, I know that a talented person is a different makeup. They have a different non-conscious. And when they come into the world, they have very, very high sensibilities. And sometimes if you don't understand those sensibilities coming into the world to a comedian or actress, whoever it is, may find certain things, whether it's a drug, whether it's a drink or whatever, that almost makes them feel normal. Did you ever experience anything like that?
Yes, but you know what? Not quite with alcohol, except for sure when I first started drinking at like 14, I did find it had a magical, like, lower the inhibitions, make me feel a little bit buzzed, relaxed. I'd always felt very anxious and I didn't even know I was experiencing anxiety. I thought this is just how people feel. It's life is suffering, you know? And when I first, 14 years old, was like, oh, this is how I can feel. This is amazing. It's very hard to keep in the buzz. Once you're, you know, drinking a lot, it's hard to stay buzzed. You always overshoot the mark. But I will tell you, first time I took Xanax, like a dose of Xanax that was really prescribed to me for postpartum anxiety. I was like, oh my gosh, this is how I feel normal. I didn't feel high. I didn't feel sleepy. I felt like, oh, this is how the other half lives. This is just, what an amazing discovery. The worst news was that I had to get off Xanax when I quit drinking.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
I mean, I'm so glad I did because, you know, I've learned to achieve that normal feeling that other people feel without, it's the long way. You know, Xanax was a nice shortcut. I really enjoyed it. But yeah, that's how I felt normal.
Well, I think that's an understanding, right? Because, you know, talented people have very, very high sensibilities. And I believe everything is about sensory. And sometimes talented people have a sensory that is focused in one area, right? So when your sensory is focused in one area and you dive deep into that and you double down on that, it creates an imbalance through the rest of the body. And I think that like education and knowledge and understanding that would be very, very important to, you know, some talented people in the world. Because I think when you reverse engineer talent, instead of trying to downplay those sensibilities, maybe we upplay them, understand what they are, because maybe there's some attributes there that could help humanity, whatever that may be. Because I think it's, because right now I think it's looked at the wrong way, I guess is what I'm saying. Does that make any sense?
You're saying that deeper level of sensitivity is what some people need to create?
No, I'm just saying a lot of very talented people have high sensibilities.
Right.
What I'm saying, how those sensibilities are recognized in society today by our medical system, how they're recognized, they are almost put down. Like, you're not supposed to feel that way. This is this. This is that. You know, we're going. You know, you need to do this because you feel this way. You need to do this because you feel this way. What I'm saying is, instead of trying to downplay those sensibilities, maybe it's an upplay and you dive deeper into them to what these are to create knowledge behind what it really is for you as a person, because everybody's different. And because we take these absolutes that blanket our system sometimes, that blanket our system that don't work for everybody. Does that kind of explain it a little more?
Yeah, I think so. Makes sense. It is pretty deep, and I haven't really thought about that. I mean, do you feel like that for your own life?
Well, just being an entertainment business, understanding how talented people are.
But you're a creator as well.
Yeah, I'm a creator as well. I mean, yeah, because I think if you don't have that knowledge, you understand what those feelings are. That's where you go to drugs. That's where you go to alcohol.
Right.
Those feelings in our body are supposed to be signals. We're supposed to understand what those signals are. And I don't think that's ever been explored.
Types of art. You could look at like writing, you know, stand up. I don't know about other things. I can't carry a tune, so I can't speak to like being a musician. But I am imagining from the stories I know about musicians, when you are a creative person, a lot of times having a slightly tortured personality goes along with it, right? But we've become very accepting of the fact that, like, oh, tortured artists. And a lot of people feel, I'll speak for myself, but I was very concerned that if I, you know, stopped being able to drink, I wasn't going to be able to access, you know, it's kind of the opposite. Do you know what I'm saying? I'm sort of responding to what you're putting out there, but like, I thought that those things went hand in hand. I thought like, oh, I have all these feelings. I'm so sensitive. I'm an artist, you know, how am I going to be able to create if I don't have access to it by use of like drugs or alcohol? But I did. It's better without it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that my writing got worse.
Well, it should get, what I'm saying too, it should get better. You know,
it takes a while though. You got to adjust. This is why so many people have trouble getting sober. It's hard. It's hard. You feel like you're going to lose a lot. People don't realize that when people are addicts and their life is kind of built around this thing that they think is medicating them, and they think I'm not going to be able to do any of the things I did if I'm not drinking. And I think a lot of people, you know, addiction is really misunderstood, because from the outside, it looks like, well, why don't they just stop drinking? Because it's ruining their life. Their life is going to be so much better. But for people, especially for people that are creative or sensitive or have all these feelings, these are a lot of the people I've met in sobriety. We all understand that, like, that's a big ask to stop doing the thing that we think helps us function and do our jobs and keep our marriages. And you know what I'm saying? So it's really scary. It's like letting go of the life raft. You don't know what's going to happen. You have to just have faith that you're going to be okay, only because if you know other people who have been through the same thing.
You know, I have this other thing about pocket narratives, because I think absolutes don't work and pocket narratives drive society. So if that pocket narrative was different for those people in your group that you were talking about just now, and it told him to maybe dive into that, you know, maybe they become a superhero. You know what I mean? Maybe they tap into something that they didn't know they had that was even more, you know, gave them more ability, is what I'm saying. That's when you dive into those things and not try to downplay them and say it's a problem. If you just looked at it from a completely organic standpoint, because of things that have hampered talented people, there could be some things we haven't tapped into yet.
But we live in, you know, such a self-help society where one of the things that we all do, I feel, is put ourselves down and think about what needs to be improved, instead of sometimes saying like, well, how does being a sensitive person help me? Or how does being a sensitive person, you know what I mean? Instead of being like, oh, I'm so oversensitive. Oh, I get reactive. Oh, I take things the wrong way. How do we switch that around and go, well, that also makes me more creative. It makes me more empathetic. It makes me think deeper about the world and people's problems. So, I mean, I believe that, like, let's not spend all our time going like, what's wrong with me that I should improve, and maybe get into a little acceptance of things that are our personality. I feel like maybe you're saying that.
100%. I have my own language, so you may have to interpret for me, because a lot of people don't understand what I'm talking about. I mean, I'm a very, very deep thinker. These are just things I think about when you understand the rationale behind those points, it makes a lot of sense, you know, and because I'm on this big thing about, if you really want me to get deep here, because I've always said this thing about being preventative. When you're preventative and you have knowledge behind that prevention, you can achieve a lot more. And I always said that us as a society, we feed off what we see. Okay, so when we feed off what we see, we continue to create opinions and controversy. But if we create a new environment with a new idea and we're out front, we're preventative, we lead, you eliminate those opinions and controversy. So then I always used to say that. I don't know where that came from.
Did he say it?
That's just me. I'm always trying to dig deep in humanity. I'm always trying to help humanity. But when I looked at that even deeper, it came between two things, the quantum field and the Newtonian theory of relativity. If you look at the Newtonian,
John, I'm just letting you know that I did not go to college. So know that. Continue if you dare, but I did not go to college. So, I barely graduated high school. So you're already losing me, but I'm listening.
In the Newtonian theory, is all about reactive. We're all reactive.
Okay.
So if we are reactive on something that's already happened, we're behind the curve. That's how we live. And pretty much everything, every structure in society is set up that way. Our medical system, our government, everything already happens. Then we got to try to go fix it instead of being preventative on the quantum field side, being preventative, being ahead of the curve, following creation, have a new idea. You eliminate all that. You really do. I mean, I'm not going to get too crazy, but I didn't have books in college either myself. These rationales come through. I have Native American on both sides of my family. It's somewhat of a spiritual.
Can you put any of it in layman's terms? Do you have like an example of that, of something that would happen that you get in front of so that you're not reacting to it, but are you just being in tune with the world so you can predict that something's going to happen and then you prepare for it?
All right, we're going to use this with childhood.
Okay.
A lot of creatives had trauma in their childhood. So when we're born, something that's not talked about is the non-conscious. When we're born, you have no emotions. Take out emotions is our non-conscious. And science stops at the non-conscious. They eliminate philosophy and intuitiveness, right? First of all. The problem with that is, and why our minds have been hijacked for however long, is that that's one third of law of attraction. So a non-conscious is born. They're born into an environment. Okay, you're a person. You have no feelings yet. You're a person. They're born into an environment. Based on what innately is in that non-conscious, you can predict what they would do based on the environment they're in. So if you understand that when you start, that's the beginning, right? When you understand and that's the beginning, and you start going through life as these emotions come into play, this is where your subconscious is being programmed. And you get to a certain point in life, you start responding to things with your unconscious bias. And that's you're responding based on the trauma you experienced. Based on this, you know, whatever your experience is, you start responding to things. That's where the unconscious bias comes into play. And then, you know, that's why a lot of human beings can't get to consciousness. So what I'm saying in that situation, first of all, if science recognizes the non-conscious the right way and let philosophy and intuitiveness play a part in that makeup, because that's one third of law of attraction, and people, society understood that, you know, when someone's born, what happens and how they are programmed, even though you still experience trauma, even though you may have some downfalls, even though you may have this, if you understand that information as a human being and understand that in real time. That is a preventative measure for you to be able to handle each of those situations better because you have the knowledge behind it as you go through life. That's a quantum field. That's what God wants us to do at the end of the day. They don't want the problem to be created. We're not going to teach you anything about that. We're just going to let the problems, we're going to create all the problems. Now we're going to run back and try to put a Band-Aid on it and fix it and explain it and monetize it. That's the difference. I can apply that to anything and everybody.
I mean, you're talking about some stuff that I've never really thought about before in that way. Well, except one time, but I'd done a lot of coke and then I smoked some pot and then I had some really deep thoughts and I wrote them all down and maybe it had was something like that. But what got you into thinking about this kind of stuff?
I have no idea, to be honest with you.
Uh-huh.
You not know, drug induced? No, I'm a natural healer. I'm a natural healer. I was always the partier, the crazy guy. And I always knew when I was in LA, I knew shamans and I knew all these naturists. And I didn't pay attention to them for a long part of the time I hung around them. But a lot of my celebrity friends were in that circle. And I never paid attention to it. And then later in life, when I started feeling certain things, I realized I had Native American on both sides of my family. You know, different things started to happen. These rationales started coming through. It's basically quantum physics. You know, it's basically what it is. It's just information that's coming through that I just, like when I talk to someone like you, I like to mention those things just to try to make people think. Because if we apply this, let's apply this to your life.
Okay.
They say comedy comes from darkest places. Can you speak to any of that on how you grew up?
My biological father was a comedian. He was kind of famous in the late 60s, early 70s. And so I just had humor in my family. But then I did grow up with quite a bit of chaos. And I found that I could use humor to deal with that. Like laughter was probably my first drug. I loved to laugh. I loved to be made to laugh, you know? So definitely I drew humor from darker situations, but it wasn't all dark, but definitely having childhood that I had, I think made me more of a risk taker, more like craving excitement, craving intensity. Mm-hmm. I'll say that. And then humor, you know, I was a naturally funny person.
So fast forward, now you wrote a book about not drinking, Drunkish, if you're looking for a good book out there.
Thank you.
Check that out. I think that's very relatable to millions of people in this day and time. So now looking back at that, if you understood how you were being affected in your life, if you understood that 100%, because when you're in that situation, you have no idea. But if you had the knowledge behind
Hiring for your small business, if you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Understanding that, it gave you a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Would you have handled certain things differently based on where you're at now?
Sure, but I don't know that I could have known that because, you know, it's like the frog in the boiling water. It starts out cold, warms up. Pretty soon you're boiling and you don't understand why you're in so much pain. So I don't know that I would have handled things differently. I was in my family of origin. I was living my life. I was pretty miserable, I think. And then I was doing what I could not to like feel or, you know, be so sensitive to, you know, I was repeating patterns. I think it was, unfortunately or fortunately, having something happen enough that made me want to quit drinking. And then only now can I look back. When some people quit drinking, they do a lot of work around it, right? So some of the work of being sober and becoming sober is a lot of looking at your past and figuring out what those patterns are and finding new ways to relate to things. And I think that's where I can understand what you're saying, where it's like, oh, well, now looking back, I can see that this was always my reaction to this, but that always leads to pain or misunderstanding or making a situation worse. So maybe now that I know where these reactions came from, it's like, here's a good example. I was criticized a lot as a child. So getting older, I became very allergic to criticism. You know, you don't want to criticize me because I will be very defensive and I will tell you why you're wrong about me. And a lot of that was fear, right? It's fear because it makes you feel bad.
I won't let you finish, but that speaks to exactly what I'm saying. That programming was part of your life that puts you in that specific point. So if you could rewrite that program and understood what that was doing at the time before it happened, you may handle those situations differently, is what I'm saying. So go.
I guess what I'm saying is I don't know how I would have done that as a kid, but what I can do as an adult is go, why do I have this big reaction when somebody wants to give me constructive feedback? Why do I become a little kid again and go, well, they're wrong. Well, screw them. Well, I don't have to listen to that, you know, and be defensive when sometimes, you know, and you learn through doing, through part of the program that I'm in, we apologize when we do something wrong. Well, it's really hard. Like the first time you apologize when you don't even necessarily fully feel in your body that you did something wrong, but somebody's having a reaction to something that you did, and then you have to own that behavior. And then guess what? The world doesn't explode. You don't feel terrible. Like you feel bad. The other person goes, you say, oh, I'm sorry if I said that thing that hurt your feelings. Even though in your head, you're like, I don't know why that person got their feelings hurt by what I said. I obviously didn't mean it like that. But when you say that, and then the other person says, oh, no problem. It's fine. Thank you for apologizing. It creates this positive thing. And then you start to realize, oh, this thing that I do where I get defensive right away is not serving me. So perhaps I can pause the next time somebody says something that I don't like. I can pause and take it in and then decide later, was that person being an asshole or was I just being sensitive and reactive? So in that way, I think as an adult and as a sober person, I can rewrite some of my, you know, those patterns.
If this was a narrative that everybody in society knew, you know, from everybody that's alive, from 0 to 100, you know, if they knew this information and the knowledge was structured the right way, society could be a little different and things could be handled a little different. That's a preventative measure. You know what I mean? Instead of just letting these things go down the road and then we put a Band-Aid on it because we wanted to capitalize on it. You know, so to me, it's like, you know, if you understand the quantum field, there's one quantum field, there's one God, there's one answer. Sensibilities are light or dark, you know. Discovery, you know, wherever you land on discovery in life could go to light or dark. It's just like when I think about Oppenheimer, you know, they tried to portray him as being this smart person. He wasn't that smart, you know, if he really looked at things the right way, because, you know, he didn't need to split an atom. We don't need to manipulate things that don't need to be manipulated. We need to understand things from creation. If we understand things from creation, we get to the answers quicker and we utilize those resources the right way. Because there's two mindsets in the world. There's a discovery mindset and then there's a creator's mindset. You know, that's just the way I look at things. I don't know. This is what I try to do on my show. It's like, how can I make people think more and how can I relate it to their own, you know, how can it improve things for them? You know, making them think, you know, does that make any sense?
Yeah. Do I need to Venmo you for this? Is it PayPal? Do you do both? Right?
I like that. That's pretty good. So
you got to write this all in a book, John.
I'm just trying to get somebody to understand me.
Uh-huh. That's a very basic human need, right? To just feel understood.
Yeah. Well, just to translate what I'm saying, because people mm-hmm. tell me, they're like, you're deep, you're way out there. We gotta make this. I had this tarot card reader who writes the tarot card section for Cosmo. She's like, John, she says, you gotta make this simple. It's very powerful what you're saying, but you gotta make this simple where everybody can understand it.
Yeah.
You know, that's mm-hmm. that's what I'm trying to figure out.
Do you believe, are you psychic?
I can tap into people. Yeah. A little bit. Yeah.
Do you think that a lot of psychics are frauds? I mean, do you believe in any of, like, these people that have TV shows where they're like mediums? Do you believe in any of those people?
There's some that are real, some that are fake. I interviewed a guy that had, I mean, there's only one guy that had this in front of his name, but it said master. He was a master mm-hmm. and ranked in the top 20 in the world, most spiritual people. And he, to me, he wasn't real. Because the difference between me and everybody else, I feel, when I talk, what I talk about, I feel daily. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have energy coming through my hand daily, you know, and I have these sensibilities that sometimes I have to manage the right way, because it can completely take you out of the whole process. So everything I talk about, I physically feel.
I'm thinking of a number between 1 and 10. I believe that if you are really in tune with somebody, and this is no slam on our connection, I think it's good. But like, you know, when you're very close to somebody, and like I used to do this with best friends at slumber parties. I could do it with my daughter when she was little, if I was like laying in her bed with her before she goes to sleep. I really believe that you can get on the same mental plane and transmit numbers and colors. And like, I've done it where it's like the person gets it right on every try. So there's something to it, right? There's something to being psychic, but yeah. I get so caught up because I want to believe like some of these psychics, and you know, then you watch these debunking videos about them and it's so disappointing how many of them are fraudsters.
Yeah. It goes back to sensibilities, you know, and their vibrations. If their vibration, like I can't pick out, sometimes I can't be poignant with things, but I can tell people who they are. You know what I'm saying? I can give them a definition, but I can't be poignant with answers. I understand that. Maybe I could be poignant with specifics if I dialed into it more. But that speaks to the quantum field as well. We're all connected. You know, we are all connected. And if we could figure out how to utilize that, you know, there's really something to that. Because I give the example of the holidays. You know how when you feel during the holidays, you feel upbeat, you feel a spirit, you feel good energy, you feel positivity. Everybody feels it because everybody is more positive during that period of time. So, but they don't realize that this is, if we could carry that mentality year around, everybody could feel that year around.
I know, that is such a good point. But then again, it's also a little bit exhausting. I think, you know, we build up to this thing and we put expectations too on these holidays, right? And so you're like trying to please everybody and you're wanting to make sure they love their gifts. And then you really enjoy the hell out of this one day. And then you're like, okay, back to mm-hmm. regular life. So mm-hmm. could we keep up that level of holiday intensity all year long?
I have this other rationale about negativity. I think mm-hmm. it's more about just a positive mindset. I made this comment one time about Netflix, because Netflix algorithm is based on sensibilities. And sensibilities are what people want to see. And I said, I bet you that 70% of Netflix's programming is dark. And I thought it was more. But because we perpetuate so much negativity, that's what people want. That's what the law of attraction is. And that's what people want to see, because you know, that's what's perpetuated.
That is a really good point. And a lot of us, not you probably, but me and a lot of people I know, are very into the true crime genre. And sometimes mm-hmm. I have to, if I listen to a bunch of it in a row, I'm like, why am I doing this? This is so negative. And it really can affect my mood and it can affect my outlook on the world. And sometimes I have to kind of swear it off for a while. And I have sworn off the really dark stuff, the, you know, murder porn. No way. I don't listen to it anymore. I don't care for anything that has to do with like serial killers. I'm more like psychological stories of learning about why people do the things they do and how they tick. But I have become really aware of how listening to too much of something that's dark can affect my moods, make me irritable, make me suspicious of people, right? I'm trying to be more positive.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I used to go watch horror movies. I can't watch them now because I literally, based on the soundtrack and the visual, my body can feel, it's like tingling just going all over me. Like, I can feel it. I can't do it. And the power of the mind is a big thing. I mean, I didn't get into the pineal gland, but your God's data center is the pineal gland. So if you want more sensory, take out fluoride out of your whole system. You know, go away from anything that has fluoride in it, because the fluoride, fluoride calcifies your pineal gland. Right. So most people's pineal gland is calcified. So you can, if you decalcify your pineal gland, and there's ways you can do that from eye drops, from the Amazon, food you eat and so forth, your sensory will improve.
Interesting. But then how do you keep the cavities away?
I think that's a myth.
People getting fluoride prevents cavities?
Yeah, I think that's a myth. I mean, there's only two countries that allow fluoride in their country in the whole world. I think it's us and Sweden or somebody. Yeah. No, but no other countries allow fluoride into their country.
But think about other countries where they have really bad teeth. Maybe that's why.
I don't think it has anything to do with it.
You don't? Mm-mm. You think it's just a coincidence?
I think it's something that's been, it's a pocket narrative that's been sold to us. I think there's other ways that you can have healthy teeth. I can't tell you exactly what they are, but I think there's other ways.
Got it.
Just like the calorie. You know, I've taught the guys, at Cambridge, the calorie is a pocket narrative that was created to sell food, and it doesn't mean anything. So when you look at the board who puts together the calorie system, it's the meat industry, it's the milk industry, it's all these industries trying to monetize their industry through this calorie system. Calorie is a bullshit.
What about fat?
What's that?
What about fats?
Fats?
Yeah, like, you know, when you look at the label of something and it tells you the calorie amount and the fat amount, the fat content.
I don't know. I don't look at that. I look at that more foundational too, because if you take a pharmaceutical grade protein and that hits your system first, a very high protein, whatever it is, that puts your muscles in anabolic state. So once you put your muscles in anabolic state, that burns fat. Then whatever you bring in, whether it's fruit, vegetables, I kind of explain it like this, superfoods, whatever it is, you take that in to cleanse and heal the body after you put your muscles in anabolic state. So I didn't want to get off on a tangent there, but what do you think about comedy today and thought processes in your world of the comedy business?
That's an interesting question. I still enjoy comedy. My kids are really into comedy, watch like SNL. I like certain things. I think that it's gotten really polarized. I think that there are a lot of sort of these anti-woke, cancel culture people that are no longer being funny. They're just ranting about how they can't say the things they want to say. And that is such a turn off to me. Thank you for giving me a platform to speak my mind about that. I think when people want to just be really negative and punch down and then get mad when they so-called get canceled, even though they're not getting canceled, because many comedians that have gone like super extreme in a direction of like, I want to be able to say what I want to say, like, then say it, then say the things you want to say. Nobody cares. Like, most comedians are not cancelable. So I've gotten really disappointed with how many people I used to think were so funny that have just gotten obsessed with whether or not they're canceled and that they're not allowed to say the things they want to say, and more enamored with comedians that are still just like being funny. Like Patton Oswalt is my favorite comedian. Like, he's not going to get canceled because he's just a freaking funny guy who's talking about himself and talking about life. You know what I'm saying? I don't like these soapbox, like, I'm not allowed to say anything. Even what I'm saying right now is going to get me canceled. I hate the whole cancel culture thing. And I think comedy's gone far afield of what it used to be, which is just being funny.
That speaks to a pure source, because I think comedians got to be authentic to themselves. They got to tell a story through their own life that's that's relatable to the masses. And I think that's it. I think it goes again to what you said. I think society has manipulated that in a way. You know, because if you saw Eddie Murphy Raw, you know, if they released Eddie Murphy Raw today, what do you think would happen to Eddie Murphy?
Funny, my husband and I were just talking about that the other day. And well, here's the problem. Raw was very, you know, homophobic. I mean, there were a lot of jokes that were punching down. Now, do I necessarily think that Eddie Murphy is like a homophobic person? No, I think that at the time where society was, like, that was a thing to make fun of. Like, that was funny. And I think Eddie Murphy was like a genius. And I remembered feeling like my life was changed by watching that special. Would I enjoy it now? No, I would find a lot of parts of it offensive. Would I try to cancel him for something that he said in the 80s? Of course not, you know? But I think that, like, we can do better. Like, as we progress as a society and realize that when we punch down, we're just making life harder for the people that we're punching down on. And, you know, the further we progress and go, well, that's just not really an acceptable, like, why do I want to make people laugh by berating other people? But I think that the best comedians make that progression naturally. Like, I don't think that today Eddie Murphy would do a special where he was going off on, like, homosexual people. Do you know what I'm saying? It's mm-hmm. So the people that are still doing it and like, but I have the right to do that. That's who I'm annoyed by. Yeah. It's like, you have the right to do it, but like, please don't. There's other things that you can make fun of. You can get the low-hanging fruit, or you can like challenge yourself to actually be funny.
How about like one of my favorite funny guys is Red Fox.
He had some important stuff to say and he was super funny. And like, I think Red Fox today would do just as well.
And you forget about Steve Martin. You know, if you look at Steve Martin's stand-up when he was in his prime, what do you think about a Steve Martin today in his prime?
Steve Martin would still kill today. Steve Martin is a brilliant, brilliant man. And, you know, a very deep thinker and really funny, but also just really silly, you know, that his comedy mm-hmm. was never like hurting anybody. I grew up on that, his album. Remember Let's Get Small and mm-hmm. Comedy Isn't Pretty. I mean, I mean, so many things that I think still would hold up today. If you re-listen to that.
So do you have any thoughts about yourself in the comedy world in the next couple of years?
Well, I don't do stand-up anymore. I stopped doing stand-up when my twins were born. The last time I did stand-up, I was pregnant, massively pregnant with twins. And I made a little joke on stage that you could actually find on YouTube where I said, I'm a little worried because I might be pregnant. I was hugely pregnant.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, August, September. And I said, I was supposed to get my period in February. And nice. Then I made a joke like that. But I never really loved doing stand-up. And once I had twins, I was kind of done with stand-up comedy itself. But I mean, I write humorous books. I host podcasts that are humorous. I have a very long-running podcast called For Crying Out Loud with my co-host Lynette Carolla. And I get to express my comedy through podcasting. I have another one called Bored AF where we just tell stories. My co-host Cecily Nobler, was a stand-up. We knew each other from stand-up and we tell stories about back in the day and we talk about news. And so I get my fix from podcasting and writing.
Would you tour the podcast?
Yeah, I have done live dates with the podcast. Super fun. I love that.
Interesting.
Podcasting is just a lot easier than doing stand-up. A lot easier and requires much less memorization.
Drunkish. Where do we find Drunkish at?
Anywhere. It comes out very soon. And you can get it anywhere. Anywhere you get books.
What's your ultimate goal for the book, you think?
You know, I hope it helps some people. I hope that it's relatable. And that anybody that's thinking about quitting drinking or silently questioning their drinking and wants to hear somebody's story that's going to be, it's just brutally honest. That's how I write. No filter. I'm going to tell you like all the thoughts I had. A lot of the book is me rationalizing my drinking. And I hope it helps somebody, you know, feel like, oh, this person, I relate to this person's story. And I hope it gives people hope that like my life this many years after quitting drinking is great. I'm super happy. I'm relaxed. Can you see it on me? Can you feel
yeah,
it?
Yeah, you look great. Ron? You're glowing a little bit. You look fresh. You look good.
I'm happy and I'm pleased with life and I don't miss drinking. So I hope that I give somebody else that same hope.
Where's your family from? Where are you from originally?
I was born in New York, but I mostly have lived here in LA.
Mostly lived in LA. Mm-hmm. So coming up with your dad being a comedian, what'd your mom do?
She was a psychiatric nurse.
Interesting. So growing up in the kind of the comedy world, what do you have any little stories that, you know, was a life changer or something that really stuck out with you that kind of maybe gave you some guidance in life?
Anything that stuck out? I mean, I would say that the bombing on stage is such a life lesson, you know, being raised. My father, when I was a kid, was on TV a lot. So I only saw like the successful, you know, I was a kid. He was already successful and on Merv Griffin Show and the Dean Martin and like killing it. So it was very shocking to me starting out in stand up that like you could have a show where you do not get a single laugh. And that builds some resiliency, I have to say. I think that withstanding going through that, thinking that that's the worst thing that could possibly happen to you. I remember thinking the worst possible thing that could happen is if not one person laughs through my whole set. That will tell me I'm unworthy, will never be successful, I'm fooling myself and all the things. And I think that going through that, obviously many, many times I've bombed. And coming out the other side and being able to do it again and then have a great set has taught me a lot about life and, you know, resiliency.
Well, I'm just looking at the name. Now, who was your dad?
Oh, you would not have heard of him, but his name was Stanley Myron Handelman.
Stanley Myron Hamilton. I had to check that out.
He was like a Catskills, very Woody Allen-esque comedian. Yeah.
Cool. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show, and I think it's been a good, interesting conversation. Hopefully you enjoyed the conversation.
I really did. Thank you so much.
Well, this has been Stephanie Wilder Taylor, and I'm John Edmonds Cosma, the CEO of Bang Productions. Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.